You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. Meltdown, the Earth Without Glaciers. You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. Meltdown, the Earth Without Glaciers is a new book by Daniel Tayant. It deals with the fact that glaciers are built and destroyed during ice ages. These massive ice bodies hold more than three quarters of our fresh water. We don't have laws to protect them from climate change. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the West Coast, Daniel Tayant himself. Good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
Thank you so much, Al. It's great to be on your show.
The pleasure is all mine. Glaciers, we kind of know. In fact, we say we kind of know about. We know they've been in danger. We've seen these pictures of glaciers falling into the sea. How serious is the problem?
Yeah, well, you made a good point there. We think we know. We've seen glaciers in the press with so much being discussed about climate change. Glaciers are always front and center in this debate. And one of the problems that we're facing is that they are melting very, very quickly. This is a tenth of the surface area of land on the Earth that's covered by white ice, you know. And one thing we think about immediately when we talk about glaciers is their melt and sea level rise. But there's so many other impacts of melting glaciers. When you wear a dark shirt on a very hot day, you get really hot. And glaciers, because they're white, they reflect heat that's coming in from outer space away from the Earth. And when they melt away, what's revealed? Darker surfaces. And that warms the planet. And it just adds so much more to climate impact. And then there are a bunch of other ways that glacier melt affects the planet. And one of those that's really important for Europe is the changing temperatures of the ocean and how the circulation that's so important to the ocean gets altered. So to give you an example, cold water from the northern parts of the planet will run towards the equator. They warm up and then they come back up and they hit Europe. And those warm waters are so key to keeping Europe very, very warm as compared to, for example, Canada, which is on the same latitudinal level, but is not as warm as Europe. And so the disruption of these ecosystems because of glacier melt will really alter our climate.
I've had people say to me, yes, but this is part of the general behavior of the planet. We've had ice ages before, you know, global warming, climate change is just something in the natural order of things. It's nothing new, and we can't do anything to fix this. What's the difference?
Yeah, so there's a lot of truth to that, but we have to dig a little bit deeper to understand what's really happening now. So yes, it is true that we have had this cycle recurring over and over again in the Earth's history. And ice ages, basically, that's when glaciers grow and get very large. And by the way, even in Spain, in the Pyrenees, there used to be glaciers that were up to 40 kilometers long, streaming down the Pyrenees into Spain's territory and also on the French side. And this happens. This happens naturally. And the Earth goes through these cycles every 100 to 120,000 years, approximately. And between those periods, between that time when there's a lot of glacial ice and the time where there isn't, and the glaciers have melted and the water goes back into the oceans, we have what's called the interglacial period. And we're so lucky right now to be in one of those periods. And that's a time of planetary climate where things are pretty good and very livable. And what we want is for that period to last for us, because if it doesn't, we go spiraling out into a very different climate. And what we're doing now, and this is why climate change is so important, and it's not just a matter of natural cycles, we are accelerating glacier melt. And what's happening is we are spinning that natural cycle out of control to the point where things can get so off from their normal cycles that our planet becomes unlivable. We can either go into a deep freeze in Europe where things just completely freeze over and make it completely unlivable, or we can go into what's called a hothouse Earth, where all glaciers have melted, seas continue to rise, you know, more than 50, 60 meters than they are now, which would cause havoc, as you can imagine, and the Earth really becomes unlivable for the human race.
The thing is that, I mean, I've seen people say, oh, yeah, but hang on a second. If the Earth is warming up and the glaciers are melting, then how are we going to go into a deep freeze?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is counterintuitive, but this is how this works. I was explaining briefly this ocean circulation, and that goes along with the jet streams, you know, the air currents that are over the ocean. And so it's really important that the ocean maintain its ecological balance. And so this churning and circulation that's going on, it brings the colder waters of the Arctic region, and this is happening in the southern hemisphere in reverse, but it brings the colder water from the Arctic regions down to the equator, warms it up, and then sends it back up to the Arctic. And that's where that warm water goes through Europe. And so, you know, that circulation, it's like a conveyor belt system in the ocean, or you can think of it maybe as the cooling system in your car. You know, you have pipes running through your engine that take antifreeze, and it circulates through the engine, and that helps the engine, and it helps the engine because it cools off parts that are too hot. If you stop that circulation, what happens to your engine? It overheats, right? And it goes completely off balance. The ocean works in the exact same way, and the climates work in the same way. If you break up that circulation, what you might get is very intense ocean heat water in the equatorial region and extremely cold water and weather in the northern. And that's where this circulation just takes everything out of sync and creates just unlivable weather patterns.
And not only unlivable, but unstable. I mean, we're at the moment, I'm sitting in Spain. We have had one of the driest winters on record. Yet in the UK and Northern Europe, they've just been hit, especially the UK was hit by four storms in a week. This presumably is another effect.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, what you're going to see over time is this destabilization of weather patterns. You know, the Earth has warmed quite a bit since we started with industrialization a few centuries ago. And what we are seeing is this progressive warming of temperatures beyond a point where we can actually do something about it. And you know, the scientists that study climate change have told us that warming should not surpass 1.5 degrees Celsius. And if it does, we get into these irreversible tipping points beyond which there's no return. Now, the planet as a whole has already warmed about 1.5 degrees of that 1.5. That only leaves 0.4. But Spain, specifically the region where Spain is located, has warmed a lot more than 1.1. It's already up to about 1.6, 1.7. And so Spain is in this runaway climate warming that's taken over the region. And what that does is that begins to create these erratic weather patterns where you get periods of intense heat or maybe even intense cool, extreme weather events like storms followed by droughts. And if you start to compare with other regions of the planet, like California, that's living similarly, you begin to see these patterns recurring all over the world where you're getting intense heat leading to drought and drying and intense fires, and everything becomes unlivable over the long term.
Also in the book, you talk about, permafrost.
That's
the
I think
one.
Is what
yes,
you're talking
that's
about.
That's the one. Sorry. Yeah.
Yes. So these are terrains that remain very cold. This is the Earth that's frozen. Mm. And you tend to find these in areas of high mountain environments. You know, you're also going to find it nearer to the poles. It's where the Earth is actually frozen, and it holds water, but it also holds other things, like organic matter. This could be because an ice age has covered a forest, or there have been animals and other life forms that have been buried in the ice and in the earth. And it's really important that these cold regions stay cold because they're holding a lot of decayed matter, and decayed matter has gases, it has CO2 gases, but it also has methane gas. We can talk about that in a moment, but that's become very, very important in the climate debate. And as the planet warms, and here's the killer, while we're warming, you know, at a certain rate in Spain, for example, or in Central Europe, the Arctic regions are warming 3 to 4 times faster. And that's destabilizing everything because all those frozen regions are melting. And when they melt, a lot of things happen. And one of the most important things is this release of organic decayed matter. And that sends up methane gas into the atmosphere. Some scientists are talking about a methane bomb that could be released. Methane is 86 times more potent as a climate causing pollutant than CO2. And you can imagine if we just started releasing CO2 at 86 times the rate that we already are, you can imagine the havoc and the chaos that that would cause in the climate.
And not only that, but the word I was looking for, by the way, was the periglacial environment, because this is interesting. I've come across most things in my life, but I'd never come across invisible glaciers. Now, explain this concept. I mean, you know, they're there that we can't see them. I mean, how can you miss a glacier?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I do this thing with little kids where I show them exactly how that happens. There are glaciers that can be 100, 200, 300 feet thick, and you can't see them. You can be standing right on top of them, and you don't see ice, you don't see snow, you don't see anything. But underneath your feet, underneath the rock of the earth, there is an actual glacier. And if you go on Google Earth, even on your phone, I could give you a coordinate, and you can actually see these right on your phone. The Pyrenees in Spain, on the border with France, have these glaciers, as do the Alps, and as do many parts of the world. So this is how this happens. It has to do with something called the geocryogenic process. That's a crazy, complicated word that basically is about rocks and ice, geo and cryo, right? And so imagine this, and I do this with little kids right in their homes. We send them home with scientific experience. You can make one of these glaciers right in your refrigerator. Just take a Tupperware, so some container, fill it with small rocks, to about, you know, three quarters of the way. It's not really important how much you fill them. And then put water up to the level of the rocks and then put it in your refrigerator, in your freezer. Let it completely freeze. When you take it out of the refrigerator, you'll get this blob of rocks and ice. Well, take it out and leave it out for about half an hour. So half of it melts. And then you put it right back in the freezer. And then it refreezes. Now, when you pull it out the second time, now you have about a centimeter of ice underneath. And then all these rocks that are slowly moving up. You do this about four or five times. What you end up with are rocks on the top and ice on the bottom. And this is what's happening in the mountains. At nighttime in these high environments like the Pyrenees, everything freezes. And it does this most of the year. And then during the day with the hot sun, things melt. Well, not everything melts. And that water trickles down into the ground. And at night, it refreezes. Over decades or even centuries, you end up with thick layers of ice underneath the rock and rocks on top. And that's what we call a rock glacier. And what's happening is that this ice continues to act like a normal glacier. And that means it moves with stress and it slides down the hill and it takes all the rocks with it. So if you look at it from the sky, so a Google image, you see this flowing rock formation coming down the mountain. And underneath that, there is ice, thick layers of ice. And this is what we call rock glaciers. They work very much like normal, regular, visible glaciers, as you're more familiar with. And they're all over these high mountain environments where it freezes at night.
And what sort of effect is that going to have? I mean, what climate, if the world is getting warmer, presumably will these glaciers thaw? Will we have the risk of, I don't know, avalanche activity, sort of land-based tsunamis, for example?
Yeah. So first of all, on the rock glaciers, climate change affects everything because it's affecting what freezes and what doesn't at night. But what is good for the rock glaciers, not that climate change is good for them, but they will last longer. And that's because they're protected by rock cover. So as the Pyrenees glaciers disappear, you know, you've lost already about 90% of ice, glacier ice in the Pyrenees over the last couple of centuries. The rock glaciers that are underneath these permafrost environments will last longer, and they will continue to provide water to the ecosystems below. And this is one of the most important features of glaciers. They hold ice and water, or water in the form of ice, over the warmer months. So when the snow falls in the wintertime, you accumulate water reserves. If there were no glaciers or no permafrost, all of that would melt very quickly in the spring, and you wouldn't have water streaming into the downstream water basins. But with glaciers and with paraglacial environments that have rock glaciers and other forms of ice in the ground, you do have a trickle of water happening all year round. This is critical to the ecosystem. So you said one other thing. You made another point, which is very, very important, which is the destabilization of these land environments in relation to the ice. And this is not only a feature of the paraglacial environment, but also big glacier environments. As the Earth warms, glaciers begin to melt and their structures begin to go weak and they end up crumbling and falling apart. And what's happening is all of this creates enormous risk of landslides and even glacier tsunamis, where big pieces of ice fall into glacier lakes that are immediately below the glaciers, and those cause enormous waves that can come running down mountains and take out everything in their path, including any agriculture that's there or human civilization.
That's a worrying concept indeed. We heard reports, and obviously there were events like the COP26 last year. We're hearing the latest scientists say in the IPCC's report that we've got less than 10 years to stop climate change. What happens if we don't? What happens if, Daniel?
Yeah, it's a scary scenario, and you've mentioned a few things that are really important here. The latest science is telling us, it used to tell us that, you know, if we went to net zero, you've talked about this, I'm sure, decarbonizing our society, putting in electric vehicles, getting rid of CO2, all that is great. But CO2 lasts about 100 years or more in the atmosphere. And it's going to be around for a long time. Even if we got rid of all CO2 right now, today, everything gone, and tomorrow we're a CO2-free planet, we're still warming and we're going to continue to warm for hundreds of years. And so we're not going to fix the problem. Then the question becomes, you know, how do we cool the planet? And what the science is showing us is that we're going to hit those tipping points a lot sooner than we thought. Where we thought before that maybe if we did this by 2050 or 2100, we'd be okay. The science is now saying, no, that's actually wrong. We're warming too fast. And we're going to pass that 1.5 threshold that the scientists are telling us we shouldn't pass because all of this becomes irreversible. And the scenario now is more like 2030, 2040. So we've got anywhere between 8, you know, to 20 years to get this formula right. And that's where these other pollutants come in. These are called the super pollutants. I mentioned one already, which is methane. Methane is 86 times worse than CO2 as a climate forcer. And the good thing about addressing methane is, unlike CO2, which is in the atmosphere for hundreds of years, methane only lasts for 8 to 10 or 12 years. And since it's so potent as a climate polluter, if we get rid of it soon, and I'm talking about the next few years, we can make a big dent in stopping climate change. So I'll give you a great example. Another one of those pollutants is black carbon or soot. Remember in the height of COVID where everything closed, everything stopped, the plane stopped, the car stopped, the truck stopped, the ship stopped. The air cleaned up real fast, just in a few weeks. And there were communities in the base of the Himalayas or parts of India that had never seen the Himalayas because of the air pollution. And in just a few weeks, we were to clear that up, and all of a sudden the skies were transparent. This shows you how these super pollutants that have a huge impact on climate change, addressing them could go real fast and produce results that we need to slow climate change in the next few years.
The thing is, it's all very well, experts like you say, you know, telling us to do this and do that and advising us. And we, the people, may want to do this, but you also need a political leadership that's going to embrace this as well. And at the moment, for example, in places like Brazil there and other places and other countries, there are political leaders who, for one reason or other, are saying, you know, don't back the science. They have lobbying groups from you know, old fossil fuel burning lobbyists, etc. So you need to get a political consensus on this, because at the moment we seem to have this chitter chatter of, you know, experts on social media and you know, this whole thing about not trusting the scientists. So we're going to need a change in policy from some several governments as well.
That's absolutely right, and you know, it's so frustrating when leadership doesn't do the right thing. Now, there is a little hope here. And if I go back to COVID again, You know, I've had conversations with my own children about this frustration. I'm a climate activist, and I work to try to influence policymakers and the very people you just mentioned to do the right thing. And the dinner table discussions have always been, well, you know, we can't really do this because industries are unwilling to stop. Political leadership is unwilling to tell industry to stop, to get out of fossil fuels. The massive, massive economic changes and the restructuring of our economies to depend less on fossil fuels and use more renewables seems like something that's impossible to do. But if you go back to the COVID example, you know, we did this in very few weeks. The entire planet got together and did the right thing, and we stopped in our tracks. And this was a positive moment for climate. It didn't last very long because we went right back to business as usual. But we need to take these opportunities that we have to make those huge structural changes. You've got a problem right now in Europe, this unfortunate crisis playing out between Ukraine and Russia. A lot of this has to do with energy. And this is a moment where we can make big changes. You know, Europe has to move, just like the rest of the world, has to move out of its reliance on fossil fuels. And sometimes big events like COVID or like this Ukraine-Russia crisis give us this opportunity to rethink the dependencies that we have on certain technologies that are not helping us. And this is the moment, like the COVID crisis, like the Ukraine crisis, to rethink the way that we want to order our societies, the way that we want to work, the way that we want our industries to use energy. And there are solutions out there. That's part of the good news. We know how to do this right, and we can do it right.
You talk about being a climate activist, and people say, oh, well, that's all very well, sort of shouting at people who don't want to hear, if you like. But I didn't know this, but you were involved in putting together a law to save glaciers, because apparently before you were allowed to dynamite them, which it sounds baffling, but true.
Yeah, that's just an unfortunate part of our history. So this takes us back to the mid-2000s, 2006. You know, at that time, my wife was actually the Minister of Environment of Argentina, and this glaciologist comes to her office and puts this big map on the table, the meeting table, and it happened to be a map of the central Andes, an area not too dissimilar to the Pyrenees. And he shows some spots on the map and says, well, you know, those are glaciers. And back then, people didn't really realize there were glaciers up in this part of the Andes. And maybe just like Spain, I don't know how many people really know that there are glaciers in the Pyrenees that are still there. There are not too many, but they're still there. And he also mentioned these invisible glaciers, which the Minister of Environment of Argentina didn't even know existed at the time. And then he said something crazy, which was there's this mining company. This is Barrick Gold of Canada, and this is not revealing any secrets because they were very open about it. They were dynamiting ice to get at gold. And this just intuitively seemed so wrong. And that's where we started thinking about how do we protect these glaciers. And there wasn't a law in Argentina to protect glaciers. And so we did what anyone else would do. We said, well, let's get a law and let's find other ones that we can model off of. And we started looking around, and we figured that the Swiss would have laws to protect glaciers. The Americans might, or the Canadians, or the Nepalese, or the Indians, or even the Chinese. But none of these countries had glacier law. And it was quite remarkable with so many environmental laws that we've introduced in legislation around the world over time and the vulnerability of natural resources. And considering that here's a statistic that's mind-boggling when you start thinking about glaciers. Only 2% of the water on Earth is freshwater. Only 2%. The rest is in the ocean. It's salty. You can't do much with it. And of that water, 75% is in ice, in glaciers.
Wow.
How could we not have laws to protect glaciers? But we didn't. And so we started a process of getting a glacier law on the books in Argentina. It was finally approved in the year 2008. It was vetoed by the president. By the president to defend the mining industry, but it did come back in 2010 after extensive advocacy by a lot of groups, including the organization I was running at the time. And now we have a glacier law. It's the only existing glacier law in the world, and it's there to protect glaciers, to protect the periglacial environment and rock glaciers, and most importantly, to protect the function that they have in Mother Nature to conserve water and to provide it at a rational rate throughout the year.
We live in a very busy society, 24/7. As you said, we've got several crises. And one of the ways that I like to unwind, it's a little bit unorthodox, but nothing because I'm involved with, you know, news gathering, etc. So I like to put the brain on hold, and I like nothing better than a good superhero movie. Iron Man, Batman, Spider-Man. Tell me about Glacier Man.
Yeah. So, you know, Glacier, there's actually someone that they call the Glacier Man.
Yes, but it just appealed
to
me.
Not so crazy, maybe. You might remember in the cartoon, The Incredibles, there was a guy named Frozo who would go around and use ice to fight the villains. Yeah. But this Glacier Man is a guy in the Himalayas. He's at the foot of the Himalayas. And with the decreasing glaciers of the Himalayas, which will place enormous strains on local agriculture, they're losing that ice. And remember, I spoke about this function of glaciers to ration water throughout the year. Well, if you don't have glaciers anymore, if they've all melted away, then you don't have ice. And you don't have this continuous supply of running water. So this guy started studying ways to actually make glaciers. And this is not a new concept. This has been done throughout societies around the world in mountain environments over millennia, which is the idea of ensuring that you have ice all year round. And you can do that simply by taking the ice and putting it in a place where it's cooler than the environment around, or allowing the ice to accumulate. I don't know if you've noticed, if you've ever been skiing or up in a mountain environment where it snows a lot, when you wake up in the morning, there's accumulation of snow, but it's not all placed in the same place because of the wind or because of the shade or because of, you know, physical structures in the environment. More snow accumulates in one place than the other. Well, when that turns to ice and the warm weather comes around, where there is more snow and more ice, that ice will survive longer than where there isn't. So the Glacier Man of the foot of the Himalayas basically understood that concept. And this engineer, that's his career, he basically started accumulating ice in places it was more likely to survive. And this has provided agricultural water for many months after the snow has melted in the springtime.
So where do we go from here? What is the next step, and what do you hope to shine a light on with your book?
Yeah, so, you know, my book is about glaciers because I've grown to love them and appreciate them and understand things about them that I never knew existed. You know, when I sat down to study the problem of dynamiting glaciers in the Andes, I didn't really know what glaciers were, and this is because they're so far removed from us. Most people have heard of glaciers, but most have also never seen glaciers because they haven't been to places where they form. So my original idea was to communicate information, to have people become more aware of glaciers, their importance, and their vulnerability. But I've also learned over the past decade of my work that in order to save glaciers, we have to stop climate change. And so my attention has shifted into addressing climate change. And right now, you know, we are in this emergency where, you know, this is not about having a, you know, crisis happening in 80 years in the year 2100. It's about the next 8 or 10 years and doing the right thing between now and then in order to stop this trend of global warming. And what we've been working on in the last decade is drawing attention to these super pollutants. Yes, we have to phase out CO2. That's really important in the long term, and we don't fix climate change without it. But if we don't stop polluting with methane gas, with black carbon, with dirty refrigerants that are in AC systems, we will reach those tipping points in the next few years or decade. And at that point, it's game over. It's too late. We will simply have to adapt as best we can to a climate collapse that will be, you know, at levels that we just can't imagine today.
The book is called Meltdown, The Earthwork Glaciers. It's by Daniel Tayant, who we've been talking to today. Daniel, if people want to find you on the internet, is there a website? Can they find you via social media? Or where can they track you down?
Yeah, absolutely. The organization that I founded in 1999 that has worked on a lot of these things is called the Center for Human Rights and Environment. In Spanish, it's called El Centro de Derechos Humanos y Ambiente. And we do have a website. If you just Google the Center for Human Rights and Environment or my last name, or Glaciers in my last name, you're going to find us online. You'll find the sort of work that we've been doing, the advocacy work that we do on climate change and others. And you know, hopefully you'll take an interest maybe in this issue through Glaciers. That's how I did. If you haven't been to a glacier, I strongly encourage you to go. It's an experience you've never had before. They're so beautiful. They're majestic. They're giant. They're just these enormous pieces of Mother Nature that have helped us so much over the course of humanity. They are vulnerable. In many cases, they will disappear. You're likely to have no more glaciers left in the Pyrenees within a few decades. So the last ones are just on their final moments. I will say you will have those rock glaciers left for a while, and you can find information on how to find those in the Pyrenees. Some of the publications we've done, there's one called The Paraglacial Environment and Mining in Argentina, which really explains, has a whole section on the rock glaciers for you to learn. Go out there, enjoy Mother Nature, appreciate it. And then when you get home and you have to make decisions about the appliances you buy and the car you drive, think about the planet, do the right thing. And finally, one, and you know, probably the most important thing, vote wisely. You know, our leaders are the ones that need to make a lot of this change. And if we don't have the right leaders in place, that change is not going to happen.
The book is called Meltdown, The Earth Without Glaciers. It's by Daniel Tayan. Daniel, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Giles. It's really great to be on your show and to be able to speak to your audience. That's really what it's about. It's sharing our experience, our knowledge, our questions, our doubts. Together, we can build a better place and help restore our climate, which needs so much caring right now.